It's Depression Mode. I'm John Moe. I'm glad you're here. If you visit Tabitha Soren's website, you won't find much about her former life as an anchor and reporter for MTV News. Sure, it's a spot that a lot of people remember her for, interviewing some of the top musicians of the 90s, presenting the MTV Choose or Lose election project, but that's not her life anymore. What you will find at her website is photography that is critically acclaimed and has been on display at galleries and museums all over the country, including currently at Jackson Fine Art in Atlanta. Photography is almost a misleading term for the art that Tabitha makes. It's almost more like painting. The works use layers and textures. They're often expressionistic. They look like they're in motion. She organizes the photography into series with titles, Surface Tension, Running. The series Motherlode is about the birth of her youngest son and includes pieces like The Night the Panic Attacks Started. Her series Some Blows Are Heavy is about disastrous events, car wrecks, train wrecks, cars on fire, emotional devastation. Over on Tabitha's Instagram, a lot of the photos are simpler. Family snapshots, a picture of Tabitha interviewing Tom Petty from the old days. And there are pictures and videos of Dixie, the second of three children that Tabitha had with her husband, the author Michael Lewis. Dixie Lewis died in May of 2021 in a car crash in Northern California. She was in a vehicle driven by her boyfriend, Ross Schultz, who also died. Dixie was a student at Pomona College. She played softball there. I wanted to talk to Tabitha Soren about Dixie and about loss and a grief that is difficult for most people to begin to comprehend. I also wanted to talk to her about photography. Yep, talking about a purely visual thing in a purely auditory medium. And I wanted to talk about the anxiety and panic attacks that she's dealt with in her life. I want to talk, as we always do on our show, about how mental health events intersect with one's life. And Tabitha and I ended up speaking about her appearance in one of the most iconic music videos of all time, where she almost, but did not quite, get hit by a pie. Or something that was supposed to look like a pie. Tabitha Soren, welcome to Depression Mode.
Thanks for having me.
I have a lot of serious questions. I have two very silly questions. Would you like those at the beginning of the interview or at the end of the interview?
You're the boss, however you like it.
Okay. All right. Well, let's do one at the beginning and one at the end then. Your Twitter picture is of the beverage tab, which of course is short for Tabitha. Do you actually enjoy the taste of the beverage tab?
I never enjoyed the taste of it. I don't think they even sell it anymore. You have to be a certain age to know what that is.
I hope they don't. It's the grossest stuff, I think.
I think all diet soda is gross, but I love I love the color, and I liked the glass that they had in the 70s ads that kind of curved in, you know, supposed to imply you could get a waistline by drinking more of it.
Your way to a shapely figure is through soda.
Exactly.
Let's start with your career. A lot of people know you from MTV News back in the day. I can think of a million reasons to leave journalism and focus on art. Why did you leave journalism behind to focus on photography?
I found that the more successful I got in journalism, the more I was addressing a larger audience, and therefore the work needed to be more mainstream. You have to remember that this was before the age of niche programming that we're in now. I love how many different choices we have and how you can be obsessed with these tiny little segments of the world. And that was just not television news. I had a really good time from age 18 as an intern at CNN to 30. And that seemed like plenty of time to spend in one career, in my opinion. I think I probably would have transitioned into documentary filmmaking, or I should say that I thought I would do that instead. And I went to Stanford on a night fellowship for a year where they you know, you're supposed to go and become a better journalist and not have deadlines for a year, and hung out with a lot of documentary filmmakers and discovered that they spent most of their time not making films, but rather raising money. And that was a huge turnoff for me because I couldn't even sell Girl Scout cookies as a kid. I just figured, well, you know, if 18 people at a film festival are the ones who are going to see my work, I might as well just go to this sort of pure area. I don't know. I felt a little worn out by it all, but I also felt a bit tired with the attachment to objective fact, the who, what, when, where, and why of journalism. And the art world really allows a lot more gray area. I'm still interested in truth, but it's a more complex one.
Your series Relief is up now at the Jackson Fine Art in Atlanta, and your photography is not, I'm trying to pardon the expression, paint a picture for our listeners. It's not like things that one would see if you're walking down the street and there's someone took a picture of it.
No, that's totally right. It's not street photography and it's not documentary photography, despite my background in journalism.
Can you describe what people see in these works? Because I'm sure you've been called upon to attach words to pictures many times. Can you describe what people see?
The relief body of work that you mentioned is, they're actually reliefs. They are pictures that are 3D. So I'm printing very formal, kind of conventional landscapes and portraits on very, very thick paper and carving out the paper so that bits of it come toward the viewer or away from the viewer. And I'm trying to really get away from the specificity of photography. Over the last couple of years, at least, that's been the direction I've been headed. I don't really make these decisions. You just sort of step back from the work and try to have it make sense with the previous body of work that you made. And for the last 7 years or so, I've been showing this work called Surface Tension, about the psychological effects of being on devices and managing technology all the time. And that those images had background images from my, you know, news feed from the day or my social media feeds or friends texting me images. And then over the top of them were actual fingerprints that were used. People used my iPad, left their fingerprints, and then I shot through the fingerprints. So the Surface Tension work has an actual surface of fingerprints on top of the pictures. And in Relief, I'm creating the surface by hand. And I think that was a reaction to all the studies that I learned about while making Surface Tension, about the cognitive impairment that multitasking and technology creates. Even when your devices are off, you're still distracted by them. So I think I really just wanted to make work with my hands and try to describe some alchemy of a place or a picture that people who see it it's their job to make sense of it based on their own emotional baggage, their own experiences. So even if I'm the one shooting it, I don't believe that there's this quote unquote decisive moment that is a big foundation in photography, where the photographer has pressed the shutter and then the aperture opens, the light hits the film or the sensor, and then you output truth. I think that by adding scans and human intervention or embellishment on top of a photograph that I took, that you open up this realm of possibility. You're not only playing with the focal plane, but you are just making it less specific to that landscape or person. Photographs are usually flat and you don't usually see the hand of the artist, and that's what makes the relief work different. But I would say that it's a little difficult to describe my work in general, because every project totally changes both the materials, the process, the camera, and what it looks like. So you can't say, oh, she's the one who does those foggy pictures of houses at night, or, you know, that's the person who takes all those shots on the beach. But I would say the connective tissue is me trying to visualize psychological states. So that's one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you, because I thought that we had that interest in common.
Yeah, definitely. Why is that a field of interest to you in particular? What, that connective tissue you talked about, why do you keep coming back to that?
My interest in visualizing psychological states stems from my background as well as an interest in making art that I haven't seen before. So if I'm attempting to visualize something you actually can't see, the likelihood that those pictures already exist is less so. And my God, how many photographs exist in the world right now? There's, you know, I think 12 billion are uploaded every week. My interest in making art with a camera and a lens, it really stems from the idea of making something we haven't seen before. And that's easier when you're visualizing something you can't see at all. So I think also my background, my childhood and growing up in the military comes through in the pictures. And I think that daily life in the military really, you know, at the end of the day, it just is really hinged on threat. Even if, you know, a war isn't going on, everyone around you is training for it at all times. And so you're sort of taught to look over your shoulder all the time, which does not generate a calm, cool, and happy-go-lucky person at the end of the day. I'm always, you know, on the lookout for something bad happening. And I think you can sense that in my work. So there's this, in the running pictures, for example, those are, you know, the shorthand on that is that series is that it's the fight or flight response visualized. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's really about people's shared instinct to survive. And that is something that comes from growing up in the military and having that be, you know, part of my everyday world.
This anxiety of doom being around just around the corner?
Totally.
Yeah. Well, and you're of a generation too, is right around my generation, where there was a kind of despair of brought about by the Cold War. And I imagine even more so if you're living in a military situation of like, what's the point in doing anything? You know, we're going to get blown up by the time I reach high school anyway. Did you experience that?
I know what you're talking about, but I can't say that I personally felt that. I think that for me, moving around all the time, in addition to daily life being hinged on threat, affected my connection or disconnection to the world. There's obviously a disconnection to geography if you're moving every 3 years, but you're also analyzing the different social structures, the different communities. I lived in Germany. I lived in the Philippines. In Germany, my landlords were former Nazis. In the Philippines, there were monsoons all the time. And, you know, I was the only kid that looked like me in the class. I think those are good experiences to have, not bad ones. But I think that this unconventional path kind of made me comfortable with discomfort. And because I was always the new kid. It wasn't just that. It was, you know, so much more complicated than just saying that. But I think that the disconnection made it hard to come up with a cohesive narrative of my life. I think that I'm sort of used to having to analyze what's going on internally to make sense of things externally. And that's where the connection in the art to visualizing psychological states come from, more than a nihilism.
One of your series is called Motherload, LOAD, and one of the pieces in it is called The Night the Panic Attacks Started. So, of course, that's, you know, the one that I fixate on because I do the show that I do. Have you always been prone to panic attacks?
Never, which was why it was so terrifying when it happened 2 days after my third child was born, and the panic attack woke me up from sleep, and I had no idea what was happening. I had heard people talk about having a panic attack and thought, oh, that's when they're really anxious or that's when they're really nervous. And that's not how this felt. I thought I was going to fly out the window and, you know, be the mom that was in the lunatic asylum, and the kids were very, you know, had to explain why only their dad lives at home. I mean, it felt very life or death.
Where was it in your body?
I think mainly in my chest. It's hard to remember because it was 15 years ago now, but I really had thought that I had every complication in pregnancy and postpartum that one could have already. Like, I didn't really know that this was yet another thing that a hormonal disturbance could cause. I think they don't tell moms all the various crazy things that can happen to you before or after, because maybe we'd have a population problem then. But I do think that some knowledge of what to be on the lookout for might help. I certainly knew about postpartum depression, but I didn't think of, you know, total extreme anxiety panic about a baby you were very happy to have was in the realm of possibility. But I had really good doctors who I was fortunate enough to have their cell phone numbers, and it was New Year's Eve. So I called the emergency room, of course, and they're like, you really don't want to come down here tonight. You know, we've got people chained up to beds and, you know, people screaming. And so I just texted people at home who were, you know, medical professionals. And the next day, even though it was New Year's Eve weekend, I got medicine and help. And I think they lasted maybe for about a year. You know, it's sort of it's not a steady descent back to quote unquote normalcy. I think I still carry Ativan in my purse for airplane flights and stuff like that just in case.
Yeah. So then how do you set out to portray this in photography? Because my thought is like a picture of a face freaking out. I'm not a professional artist. Like, how do you capture that unusual of a situation or that devastating of a situation in a photograph?
The Motherlode series is each of the pictures, and there are only about 20. Most of them have 10, 20, 30, 40, even 100 layers of a lockdown shot that I pile on top of each other in Photoshop. So Motherlode is intended to show how invisible one feels in the newborn stage of life, how redundant the behavior or your tasks are, how blurry or bleary-eyed you feel due to the sleep deprivation. The title about the panic attack is to give viewers a way into that stage of life and what happened, you know, that particular week. You are constantly dealt new things that you have to get through. I wouldn't say survive, but you are trying to keep this baby alive. So you're less concerned with your own health and happiness than, you know, having this child thrive. The panic attacks themselves actually are part of a body of work called Panic Beach, which is named after a Lone Justice song. I really love Maria McKee's voice so much. But they are work that is up at the State House in California and Sacramento right now. And they're all waves that are about to crash down on the viewer. So as opposed to showing somebody's face, like about to, you know, lose their mind, which would require actors probably, because with three children, I can't really have my practice be about waiting in someone's house for them to have a panic attack so I can photograph it. That's just like unrealistic. So I'm thinking about metaphor and, you know, what other visuals there are to represent that state of mind rather than the actual, this is what a person looks like when they're having a panic attack.
Looking at your website and looking at the different series that you have going on, some of them are marked as active and some of them have beginning and end dates. Some Blows Are Heavy is one of your series that I believe when I looked at it is listed as active. What are you trying to do with that series?
Well, I started working on Some Blows Are Heavy during the pandemic when people kept saying this year is just a train wreck, when we were all freaking out about COVID and we really didn't have enough information for anybody to feel calm about lockdown and nobody had a vaccine yet. So I started taking pictures of wrecks, train wrecks, car wrecks, shipwrecks, and emotional wrecks. And again, to make a picture I hadn't seen before and to allow a picture of a car on fire on the side of the road, which I happened upon, to become more of a metaphor, I'm creating a surface on top again. So the paper surface that I created during the relief work, now I'm using a different material, which is an archival resin, and I mix it with ink and acrylic paint to create an actual textured surface on top of the photograph. And what that ink and resin does is create blind spots on the photograph so that you can't, the viewer can't see the entire picture, and it sort of has to pull you in, or I'm hoping that it pulls people in to look more slowly and to also try to figure out what I'm covering up and what I'm not and why. And mainly, besides that conceptual idea, it is over time becoming more about the fact that we're all on the edge of the abyss. We just don't know it, that these things are all lurking around the corner, which I do feel like we've already talked about in this discussion because it is a recurring theme. Even though I'm able to make the visuals look very different, there is always a level of my work that is hinged on threat.
Hmm. One of the pictures, you alluded to it, is Emotional Wreck. And if you go to tabithasorin.com, you see part of that picture. I've seen it a lot of places. And I'm wondering if you can describe what's in that picture.
It's a portrait of, well, I don't...
Is that you in the picture?
Oh, gosh, no. No, it's a. It was a photo assistant. I went to Tel Aviv, and I hire a local assistant, and this woman, Omer, showed up, and she was willing to be in the photographs if I needed her to be. Often, I do need a figure in the foreground or something else happening. The problem was she was so breathtakingly beautiful that it was distracting. And no matter how you take a picture of that, it's going to look like a fashion picture. So It was just my instinct. And this was maybe 4 or 5 years ago. I wasn't working on Some Blows Are Heavy at the time, but you take a lot of pictures that you put away for a future date or a future project. And every photographer has folders of these things on their desktop. So I just saved this picture of Omer for this project. I think she thought I was never going to use a picture of her in anything. We're still in touch, but she's, you know, she can't believe that like 5 years later, it's actually of some use. But the photograph itself is just her with her head in her hands. And I did that because her face was too pretty.
Okay. What is it about that photo that you choose to feature so prominently? Is it personally very important to you, or is it highly representative, or what is it?
You know, I find that my work is very hard to look at in a JPEG. I made less complicated work, it would be easier to succeed or sell things online. So I guess the reason I love that picture so much is that it is something that translates online. It's fairly simple, more direct, but the application of ink and resin on top is obviously handmade, and you can see that it does actually jump forward from the background picture. So there is a texture there again, you know, 3D reliefs, to use the art history term. The fact that there are no other pictures that look like this out there is communicated through Emotional Wreck. But also, you know, a series that just has landscapes and images without people in them, I find are harder for viewers to enter into. I think it's definitely the human psychological state that I'm trying to get at with Some Blows Are Heavy. And so, like, to have people within the project makes sense. However, during the pandemic, I wasn't shooting people because I wasn't trying to get in the same room with strangers. That's why the project has taken me a while. I've only recently started shooting people again. And so Omer won't be the only human being in the project.
Okay, good, good. I want to ask some questions that have to do with your daughter, Dixie. More with Tabitha Soren in just a moment. You know what I like? I like when things are easy. Man, easy things are just the best, because obviously there are plenty of parts of life already that can be very, very difficult. So bring on the easy. My favorite easy things, I have to admit, are when something seems like it would be difficult, but turns out to be easy. Oh, I love that. Case in point, building your own website and web presence with Squarespace. I did this years ago and found it to be delightfully simple. I can build a site, make changes, redesign everything if I want, all very simple. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for entrepreneurs to stand out and succeed online. Squarespace makes it easy to create a beautiful website, engage with your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time, all in one place, all on your terms. You don't need to be a web guru. You become the guru. Start a completely personalized website with the new guided design system, Squarespace Blueprint. You can choose from professionally curated layout and styling options to build a unique online presence from the ground up, tailored to your brand or business and optimized for every device. Make checkout seamless for your customers with simple but powerful payment tools. They accept credit cards, PayPal, and Apple Pay, and in eligible countries, offer customers the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and ClearPay. Upload video content, organize your video library, and showcase your content on beautiful video pages. You can even sell access to your video library by adding a paywall to your content. So why not get started now? Go to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/depresh to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. squarespace.com/depresh.
I'm Lisa Hanawalt.
And I'm Emily Heller.
Wow, Emily, we've been doing this podcast for 10 years.
I know, but hey, don't worry. You can jump in at literally any episode and hear us talk about some of our favorite stuff. Caterpillars becoming butterflies.
Martha Stewart flying around in a private jet full of trees. Yes, you heard me right, trees.
Neighbors becoming enemies. Just kidding.
Whatever messed up stuff we can find on Wikipedia.
Our impeccable taste in everything from dogs to TV shows to bodily functions.
And horses. Lots and lots of horses. Come for our horned up rants about the world. Stay for the catchy theme songs.
You might not learn anything, but we're a good hang.
Baby Geniuses. Every other week on MaximumFun.org. Baby Geniuses, tell us something we don't know.
I want to ask some questions that have to do with your daughter, Dixie. In that series, Some Blows Are Heavy, there are pictures of car crashes. And were you tempted to take those down after Dixie died for your own mental health?
It's because I shot the pictures of car crashes before her car crash. There's an 18-wheeler that has flipped. And when I saw that, driving down Highway 5, I just thought I was, you know, very excited that something that I was working on was actually in front of me. And I did not associate it, had no reason to associate it with anything personal. Mm-hmm. So I don't look at those pictures and flinch. I have zillions of pictures of Dixie. There are a lot of things that make me weepy. Just driving around the streets of Berkeley, where I have, you know, 10,001 associations with her, is much harder than looking at work that I made that is more about a universal feeling and a shared instinct to survive all of the difficult twists and turns of everyday living. It is more universal for me when I look at it than personal. That said, when I showed it to curators last summer, a very important one, definitely blanched when I said I was calling the series Wrecked, but that's just what I called it as a shorthand, you know, to just to be able to talk to my assistant and, you know, which pictures I was referring to or what I wanted us to work on that day. Mm-hmm. And it was train wrecks and car wrecks and plane wrecks and shipwrecks and emotional wrecks. So it was just like a very tight concept.
Yeah, it's a slug line.
Right, exactly. Like, and he just, this curator just looked at me. He's like, you've got to change this, the series title now that this has happened. And so I chose a line from Shakespeare, realizing that, you know, some blows are heavy, just to me felt very profound because we're all dealing with sort of lighter blows all the time, right? I mean, we're resilient as human beings. And every so often there's one that just levels you. And that's the place where I am right now, because I really do think that losing a child, you know, forces you to bear the unbearable.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's, people will say, you know, how can you get through it, but you don't have a choice. You know, it's like you're so strong. It's like, it doesn't matter if you're strong or not. It's been given to you.
Especially if you have two remaining children.
Yeah. Yeah. You've done a lot of journalism, like we've talked about, and you've moved into this very visual representative medium in photography. And so it's really interesting for me to talk to you as somebody who has a good grasp of what language can do and a good grasp of what language cannot do. Are there words to describe the grief that you've experienced? Are there words for that actual grief?
Every so often, someone sends me a poem with words in it that, as most poems have. Every so often,
yes.
Every so often, there are words in a poem that I feel describe the grief. There are a couple of prose examples. Grief is a Thing with Feathers is a tiny little book that I just really related to. But it's not, I don't think that I have any unique special words to communicate. It almost feels like too much of a burden to try to crystallize the feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that was my next question. Do you feel a need or an obligation to come up with words?
No, I don't. I don't.
Yeah.
I have felt the need to come up with words when I am at a memorial for Dixie in one way or the other. I have felt like there was something to learn from her, the way she lived her life. So talking about Dixie to others, you know, her former Pomona softball teammates, for example, just to give them some perspective on her. And, you know, she was very full of joy and full of ambition and plans. And I feel like it's my obligation to try to continue in that mode and to inspire other people with her, you know, sort of attack approach to the world. You know, what she told herself when she went up to bat, the mantra that she repeated in her head was loose and aggressive. I think that sounds like a nice template of a way to live. This is something, the idea of Dixie only being gone from my sight is something that I really have been trying to come to terms with. I would say that continuing a relationship with her is what I want more than anything in the world. But I find that is something that I'm processing and creating at this very moment. We would all be better off if you go through life without a religion, like I am. I mean, I grew up Catholic, but I'm not practicing, and all of the horrible things the Catholic Church has done over time, just I cannot connect to that any longer. But I do feel like the indigenous ways of dealing with death and treating their elders or people who have passed as continuing to live in some way in their life would be so useful to me right now. And I just wish I had more of a template of that in my head as opposed to some fanciful notion of heaven. What you're saying makes absolute sense to me. It would be incredibly comforting to feel like Dixie was still in my daily life. She's in my mind and my heart, but I'm working on creating that continued relationship that I have read about, certainly in grief books and various things. But it's not something that happened to me automatically.
Coming up, what lies ahead for Tabitha Soren?
Hi, I'm Jesse Thorne, America's radio sweetheart.
And I'm Jordan Morris, boy detective.
Our comedy podcast, Jordan Jesse Go, just celebrated its 15th anniversary.
It was a couple months ago, but we forgot.
Yeah, completely. Our silly show is 15 years old. That makes it old enough to get its learner's permit.
And almost old enough to get the talk.
Wow, I hope you got the talk before then. A lot of things have changed in 15 years. Our show's not one of them.
We're never changing, and you can't make us.
Jordan, Jesse, Go, the same forever at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
When you think about what's next, either for the series that you're currently working on or for future series, for future concept albums, I guess, does it come from you and your experiences? Is that like what's in me that I need to get out there? Or is it what's interesting in the world? Like where is the source material coming from?
I think my first instinct is to have some friction or slippage with what's going on in contemporary culture. I do feel like surface tension is very successful at visualizing the technologically infused atmosphere of contemporary life. The internet is the place that the entire culture revolves around. Even if you're not on social media, you live in the world that the internet has created. And I think, like, if you're, for me, when I start thinking about technology, I start thinking of feeling distracted, having too many messages and information coming at me and not being able to handle it. But it's also a world in which selfhood has become so prominent. So I tend to start with something about the outside world, some contemporary aspect of culture, which is new or interesting to me. But then inevitably, I end up at the psychological impact of that situation. So the two are very linked. I don't think of it so much as autobiographical, but then I step back when the project is sort of more complete and realize, oh, well, this wouldn't have happened if my daughter hadn't died, or it wouldn't have happened if I didn't get raised in a military family where, you know, there was this idea of threat around me at all times. Like it's very hard to separate the two, but I never think in terms of, you know, what is happening to me that would be interesting to others. Like that doesn't interest me at all. The fact that it was very hard in the Motherlode work to actually take those pictures seriously. I put them, and mainly because I had me in them. I just thought, like, who would want that picture? You know, it's so quotidian. It's cluttered. It's not, you know, I don't have beautiful blue you know, royal sheets. I don't, you know, there was just like the color palette was wrong. But then I found those images in a safe during COVID when I was like everyone else cleaning out their houses. And I rediscovered them. And at that point, I was thinking, you know, my practice was more developed. And I realized that I could create a new surface by layering 400 images on top of each other. And how would that look? And maybe that would represent the state and make it more universal by not being about my particular newborn experience, but having it represent the state that a lot of women are in during that period of time. And I should say, I mean, perhaps they're all different kinds of artists. So I'm assuming there are people who start out their project and know exactly what the concept is and know why they care about it. But for me, it takes time to build the work and to live with it for a while. And at first, I would say the inciting impulse is to make something I haven't seen before. I think there's too many pictures out there, too many artists, too much artwork. And I want to distinguish what I'm doing. I want to make it matter. That's what I start with. And that usually involves some sort of happy accident that happens in the studio or while I'm out shooting, where I've made some mistake or that I want to then replicate. Then you're not relying on training or rules or equipment. It's about some sort of serendipitous luck. So I didn't light that car on fire. I was just driving down the road in Ohio and saw a car on fire. And I happened to have my camera equipment in the back. And I think that that's why my projects take so much time, maybe. And perhaps someone who went to art school, you know, is just much more focused and linear than I am. But one of the reasons I enjoy making art instead of doing journalism is because it is so nonlinear, and there isn't a who, what, when, where, and why quality, and there isn't a deadline at 6 p.m. And you know, I'm not working with 25 other people. Art is a real antidote to my first career.
Yeah, there are no editors in art breathing down your neck. Is it frustrating, though, in a world where there is so much photography and people are experiencing it online? Like, I think your stuff is really beautiful, but I am looking at it on my computer because I have no choice. I'm in St. Paul. Your gallery show is in Atlanta. I'm probably not going to make it. And the resolution is different. And it's not what you, the artist, intended someone to ideally see. Is that frustrating, or do you just accept that, or what?
I think if it was really frustrating, I would start making art that translates better online. And I haven't done that. So I think that there is a part of me that enjoyed having an audience of 80 million people when I worked at MTV News, for example. And now, because that is sort of quenched, that desire for, you know, huge amounts of people seeing your work, I don't feel that kind of pressure or frustration with the art world. Of course, I want as many people who can see it in person as possible. I'm in a show in Boston right now at Mass Art Museum. It's called Designing Motherhood. I'm in a show in Chicago at the Museum of Contemporary Photography called Beyond the Frame. I'm in a show at Pier 24 in San Francisco. I'm in a show in Belfast at the Ulster Museum. Like, there are plenty of places to see my work. I'm not sure that I'll ever have 4 museum shows happening at the same time ever again in my life, plus a commercial gallery show. So 5 places to see my work in person is a lot for any artist.
Yeah.
So that's nice. And maybe you're asking me that question at a time where I do have 5 cities where people can go to see my work. But at this moment, it doesn't, that's really
doesn't
not
matter.
What it's about. You know, like, there is this incredibly competitive blue chip art world out there. And really, unless you're showing in New York or London at these very expensive art fairs, you're not really a player in that. And that success is very trendy and arbitrary. And right now, it's very much about, you know, wet painting, figurative painting, often work connected to identity. And art, like music and everything else, has these trends that exist. And I think if you start making work that matches the trends, you will have a bigger audience, but the work might be terrible. So I really try to relieve myself from thinking about those things. It's really hard to make good art if you're thinking about yourself as like a fly on the wall. And that's one of the things that I really do not miss from being in television, because obviously if cameras are on you or if you're on television, you know, there is this separation between how you feel and how other people view you. And it's really nice not to worry about that anymore. Every so often, that former public life sort of pops into my daily existence in Berkeley, where I live, but it's very rare. And I remember when my oldest daughter, Quinn, was in preschool, I learned that I just needed to not assume that people were thinking about my TV career when I was interacting with them, because I was in this grocery store line and there was a woman behind me and she said, you know, did we go to college together? And I said, no. And then she said, maybe it was high school. And I was like, no.
No.
And then she was...
It was a Counting Crows interview.
Well, that was in my head, right? So I'm sitting there and I'm just patient. And I just like, I couldn't escape because I was in line, but I just let it hang. And then she turns to me a couple minutes later, right as I was about to go, I used to be on TV. She says, I got it. And I expected her to mention something about my journalism. And she says, you're Quinn's mom from preschool. I'm so glad I kept my mouth shut, because that would have been embarrassing.
You don't, you don't want to be seen as gloating in a checkout line, certainly.
Or just bringing up something that they weren't even thinking about. So it's, you know, people in Berkeley, I have to remember, don't have televisions really, so they just read books. I'm joking.
The bumper stickers told them to kill their televisions, and so they did. Yeah.
Anyway, so little examples like that. But then other times, you know, they whip out their phone and play me my Tupac interview in the middle of a restaurant.
Oh, no.
So every time you relax into thinking, well, that was 100 years ago, nobody even watches MTV anymore, I wasn't on NBC long enough for people to think about that work, then somebody brings it up.
There comes you talking to Tupac on a beach. All right. Are you ready for the second silly question and the final question of the interview? All right. When you were an NYU student, you appeared in the Fight for Your Right to Party video. Was it a polite and serious shoot, or was it just as flippant and rude as the video itself?
The Fight for Your Right to Party video was very lo-fi, much a video that did not have a budget. And I was not invited to be part of the video shoot in any sort of formal way. I was meeting my friend from, I want to say my friend from NYU, although he had graduated or not graduated by the time that I got there. His name is Rick Rubin. He's a famous, really talented music producer, among other things. And he invited me there because we were on our way to lunch. And so I just stopped by. Like, if you can believe it, like, that's actually what I wore to walk through the streets of New York City at the time. My hair was huge, heavy metal, blonde craziness. I remember getting there and thinking, you know, just watching. I'm not sure I'd ever been to a music video shoot before. And they were just in some apartment, so it wasn't anything really special. I don't remember a lot of lights or fancy cameras or anybody knowing what they were doing. It was just very lo-fi. But they said, you know, they needed extra people and to create more crowd in a particular scene. So they asked everyone who was standing around to join into the shot. And it was the scene where they are throwing whipped cream and having sort of a pie fight. I noticed that the whipped cream really smelled. It was like disgusting. And then somebody told me that because there was no prop budget, they got the whipped cream from behind the grocery store because the grocery store had put out all their expired stuff that they were then going to trash. Yeah. So everyone's throwing this expired whipped cream on them. And if you notice in the video, I'm the only person who does not end up with any whipped cream on them, not even a drop. And the whole time I'm spinning around because I'm trying to avoid really, you know, very strategically avoid right. any sort of whipped cream landing on me because those were my clothes and I was going to wear them the rest of the day and I didn't want to go around smelling. But it right. makes for a good sort of motivating action. I'm not an actor, but I believe that would be what is called motivation.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's well played. You pursued your objective as an actor. Nice work. Tabitha Soren, thank you so much for sharing your art and sharing your stories and sharing your wisdom. I really appreciate it.
Thanks. This has been fun.
If you want to find Tabitha in that Beastie Boys video, look for reddish hair piled high, like Melanie Griffith in the early scenes of Working Girl. She's dressed all in black, no stinky pie cream on her. We have a link to Tabitha's professional work on our show page, also a link to her Instagram. There are some great photos and videos of Dixie Lewis on there. Next time on Depression Mode, PTSD can take many forms, including a toaster.
It was anything that wasn't supposed to be where it was or anything out of place, you had to be controlled for. I can remember having night terrors that were as simple as there was a toaster somewhere where it wasn't supposed to be in my house. And the signal that went off in my head was something is amiss, I'm in danger. And that made no sense to me until many years later when I went to therapy, and that was explained to me as your brain learned that either it controls everything or you're gonna die.
Former soldier and former politician Jason Kander is with us. If people support our show, we can keep having a show. If they don't, we can't. I want to keep making a show, and I think you probably want to keep hearing the show. So please, support the show. It's really easy to do. You just go to MaximumFun.org/join. You find a level that works for you, and then you click on Depression Mode on the list of shows available. Be sure to hit subscribe, give us 5 stars, write rave, gushing reviews. That really helps out our show, helps it get to a lot more people and help a lot more people. The Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is available in the United States by calling 988. The Crisis Text Line, also free, always available. Text the word HOME to 741-741. Our electric mail address is depressmode@maximumfun.org. If you're on Facebook, look up our mental health discussion group, Preshies. A lot of good conversation happening over there. Our Depression Mode newsletter is on Substack. Search that up. I'm on Twitter @JohnMo. Hi, credits listeners. I was in a rock video once. Once. It wasn't for the Beastie Boys. It was for a Seattle band called The Pleasure Elite in 1994. And in the video, I was chained up in front of a TV while people played checkers on my back. Ah, show business. Depression Mode is produced by Gabe Mara. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. We get booking help from Mara Davis. Rhett Miller wrote and performed our theme song, Building Wings.
I'm always falling off of cliffs now, building wings on the way down. I am figuring things out, building wings, building wings, building wings. No one knows the reason, maybe there's no reason, I just keep believing. No one knows the answer, maybe there's no answer, I just keep on dancing.
Hi, I'm Sarah from Minneapolis. It is never too late. Do it.
Depression Mode is a production of Maximum Fun and Papa Chick. I'm John Mo. Bye now.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.